All right, so beast from the earth. This is the second beast. So let's review where we have been. In Revelation 12, we saw that the dragon, representing Satan, seeks to destroy the woman, which we said were God's servants in the collective, and her offspring, but a male child, which is identified as Jesus, is caught up to the throne of God. The dragon pursues the woman, who is given shelter in the wilderness, and the dragon loses authority to accuse the saints in the heavens, but retains power to wage war against saints on earth and sea. And the dragon seeks to war against the woman, but creation itself comes to her rescue. And so the dragon turns his attention away from the woman and instead to her remaining offspring. The first part of Revelation 13, and the first beast, we saw that the dragon calls up a beast from the sea in which is vested the power and authority of the dragon. This beast appears to have been resurrected from a deadly wound. And this, we learn that it parallels rumors that were surrounding Nero's death and a supposed future return. Those who dwelt on the earth, which are defined as those whose names are not in the Lamb's Book of Life, worship this first beast from the sea and follow after it. The beast wages war on behalf of the dragon against the woman's offspring. This war is waged through words of blasphemy against those who dwell in heaven. The beast is allowed to make war against and conquer the saints. Although, from earlier in Revelation, we know that the real conquerors are the saints. We said that the saints represent not individuals, but the collective group known as the martyr church. The martyrdom is not literal, but figurative in terms of oppression and the effect it has on the portrayal of Jesus Christ to the world. Saints are described as those who keep or hold to the commandments or the word of God, and those who have or hold to the testimony or the witness of Jesus. And the commands given to the church are found in the letters to the seven churches. The primary command reiterated in Revelation 13 verse 10 is the command to patiently endure and keep their trust in Jesus. And the witness or testimony seems to refer most directly to the book of Revelation and its purpose, which is to describe Jesus' victory over sin and that the saints have nothing to fear, and the work going on behind the scenes are being described in Revelation. On behalf of the saints that are behind the scenes. And so that is a brief review. The second beast is described in the second half of Revelation chapter 13, verses 11 through 18. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence. It makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So, first of all, examine the characters that we see in this passage that we just read. First, it's the second beast, a beast from the earth, has two horns like a lamb, speaks like a dragon, has the authority of the first beast, makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth, it gives, quote, life to the image of the first beast, and it is identified with a number, 666. Next character is those who dwell on the earth. They worship the first beast. They are deceived by the second beast, and they make an image of the first beast. The third character or set of characters is those who would not worship the image, and they are slain by the second beast for their refusal to worship the first beast. And finally, there is this character called All. And it is defined as both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave. And they are marked on the right hand or the forehead. And they are allowed to buy and sell because of the marks. So what do you think?
You got your job lined up for you.
It's pretty straightforward, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, some of us know what has traditionally been taught in the Adventist Church about this passage.
And it's so cut and dry and clear that it's going to be difficult to go anywhere else.
Well,
your job is unraveling. Unraveling.
Let's look at some of the historical, cultural, theological background that may play into how we read this passage first, in regards to this entire passage here. Although most of the details of Revelation 13, 1 through 10 could apply to the emperor of John's day and via him to totalitarian regimes throughout history, some of the details of this current passage, verses 11 through 18, suggest that John consciously anticipates its ultimate fulfillment in an emperor yet to come. So it's possible that John is applying things both to his present day and anticipating some kind of a future reprise. Verses 11 through 12 talks about the beast from the earth, as opposed to from the sea, is often thought to be the local provincial council who supervised the imperial cult in Asia, as opposed to the Roman administration. So, as we were looking at the map of that area earlier this morning, Rome is somewhat distant from the area of where Revelation is taking place. And Rome did not have necessarily direct its own personnel directing affairs there, but rather had delegated it to what would be what is called here local provincial councils. Mm-hmm. The horned lamb probably parodies Christ. The two horns might reflect the power of ancient Persia in Daniel 8, verse 6. Fire from heaven parodies and so apparently relativizes the miraculous power of God's witnesses, as Pharaoh's magicians tried to do with Moses' miracles as long as they could. So it's parody, a kind of a fake power that perhaps John is describing. Verse 13, John apparently envisions a future blending of anti-Christian state religion and occult power, both of which existed mainly separately in his own day. His source for this view is undoubtedly Jesus in Matthew 24, verse 24, and 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. And he has Old Testament precedent for the occult powers in the service of an anti-God ruler representing God's people. And this is in Exodus chapter 7, verses 11 and 22. So again, John may be anticipating something that could happen in the future. A merging of state, religion, and occult powers. Verses 14 through 15, some magicians simulated the moving and speaking of idols. So this is in his day, in John's day. They had images of different deities. And some magicians may have simulated the moving and speaking of idols. Hearing the extent to which the world can be deceived by false religion and state propaganda would evoke familiar discomfort in John's first Christian readers. They demand to worship the image which to the authorities symbolized appropriate loyalty to the state, but to the Christians would symbolize apostasy, resembled the situation the Maccabean martyrs had faced, and especially the conflicts faced by Daniel and his three friends. Again, continuing verses 14 and 15 again, an image, a Greek word is icon, was a cult statue to set up, was a cult statue set up to promote the worship of a god or a deified emperor. And the Septuagint translation of Daniel 3 verse 1 also uses the same word for image, the Greek word icon. The idea that such statues could be animated through magical rituals was common in the ancient world.
Good thing they didn't have robotics or drones.
Are you eventually going to discuss what has been the Adventist traditional teachings about this passage?
Briefly mention it.
I don't know if Amy knows.
Verses 16 and 17. A Greco-Egyptian king had similarly required Jews to be branded with the ivy leaf, the emblem of Dionysus. This is in regards to receiving a mark on the hand or forehead. This is likewise a mark of ownership, a brand or tattoo indicating to which god or empire one belongs. Like the other markings in Revelation, it seems to be symbolic. So what it's saying is it doesn't have to be a literal mark. Some Jewish texts speak of a symbolic mark of destruction on the forehead of the wicked, in contrast to the mark of the righteous. But the text may simply imply a figurative slave brand identifying to whom a person belongs, God or the world. Participation in idolatry appeared to be almost an economic necessity in many cities in Asia Minor. And John warns that commercial discrimination would grow more severe alongside the graver danger of martyrdom. So, you know, for John then, you know, what he wrote about the mark of the beast and not being allowed to buy or sell, you know, it doesn't, it's not a huge big thing. It's just, well, it was happening.
So did, you know, in those days, did their friends help them out, or how did they survive?
It probably depends on where a person lived.
Black market.
You know, in some places it wasn't as severe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the, well, I think the Christian community at that time, you know, if a person was able to, had a surplus, you know, they would be able to pass it on to those who were suffering.
Could it have been something like what existed in some places in America where black people may not shop here, that sort of thing? Discrimination against certain groups of people in who a business will serve, etc. Or maybe even more widespread.
I'd say it was less of a person being allowed to buy or sell, but simply Christians lack the means because they lack the means to be able to. Because in many places the guilds controlled the livelihood of people.
Unions did that a little bit. Quite a bit. What's the difference between the two groups?
Which two groups?
The people of the earth?
The ones with and without the mark.
Oh.
The ones without the mark wouldn't subject themselves to the...
The ones who don't have the mark are the ones who have the seal of God, the 144,000.
What does that mean? What was different? If you saw two people standing there, what's the difference?
Probably nothing visible.
It was, as this commentary reads, it's probably nothing visible. But it has to do with a person's loyalty.
So what does loyalty to God versus loyalty to the emperor mean? I mean,
externally at that time, loyalty to the emperor would mean participating in the imperial cult.
And the idea of a mark could, like it says here, it could imply a figurative slave brand. You've been marked as...
By participating in the imperial cult, a person is basically saying Caesar is God.
Uh-huh.
Or the emperor is God.
And if you don't say that, then they cut your head off.
No, it's...
No.
No, it's just you're branded as somewhat... your loyalty is in question.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you refuse to get a mark, you know, to say, yes, I...
It's not a literal mark. It's just your reputation.
Just a participation.
It's your reputation.
Yeah.
Who do people see you as loyal to?
So if you're loyal to Caesar...
Or the emperor.
The emperor. And the other person is loyal to God, there's got to be some difference between the two groups. I mean, just saying I'm loyal to Caesar, I'm loyal to God, well, that doesn't do nothing.
Christians did not participate in any of the imperial cults.
Activities.
So
there must have been some
your activities, your who you trust. Not necessarily a mark that someone could tell, could say obviously, oh, they've got a mark and they don't have a mark. But maybe because slavery, if someone is slave to someone else, they are visibly marked, and maybe that's part of why it was called a mark.
Well, let's read this next piece here. The Israelites bore God's law on their hands and foreheads to signify His authority over their deeds and thoughts.
Right, the templing.
So their deeds and thoughts would be different than another person's deeds.
Yeah. Neither the beast's mark nor the seal of God on believers' foreheads have to be understood as physical features, though they may be that. Both symbolize the spiritual control of heart allegiance and behavior, either by the beast or by the lamb, but God's seal secures safety.
I think the word I'm seeking is the behavior. What's the behavioral difference between the two groups? And last
week, allegiance is pledged to.
But it has to reflect in their behavioral actions. And what you always pulled me back to last week is it's a matter of who you trust. And the word trust really got a lot more meaning in it last week. If you're trusting into the emperor.
If you're not fully trusting in God, then you will participate in the imperial cult, because that is a easy way to make sure that your livelihood is not compromised.
Whereas those on Mount Carmel put their trust in God, which was not something they did, it's not something of themselves, it's something beyond them. Their trust is unmerited trust.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who do not worship the emperor would say that their sustenance, their life, is trusting in God versus in the emperor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by not participating in the imperial cult, they're saying that, no, it doesn't... What the emperor's power is limited. No, the imperial authorities may restrict what they can do, but God will continue to provide. And even if God does not provide, as in Daniel's three friends, we will continue to trust in God.
Well, this borders real close to the situations that we have, more so in the East than the West, but with unions. Do employees pay union dues? Do they participate? Do they trust in the union to protect their future? Or do they rebel against the union and basically are precluded from having any job? So, I never really come to grips with that one either, because unions is totally a work situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how it bleeds into religion.
Mm-hmm. Does it not? Does it in some situations?
Mm-hmm. And this idea of the mark on the forehead or the hand comes from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 8. Now this is the Shema. Basically, the most famous, probably, of Israelites, Jews recite. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes.
Mm-hmm. So in Deuteronomy, there was talk of a mark on your hand.
Yeah,
and it's something that was in the front of their minds all the time.
It's supposed to be symbolic,
yeah.
But there are certain segments of the Jews made that a literal thing.
Binding something to their hand and their head. And so a mark on your hand and your head would be something that people would find familiar.
And when Jesus was asked, what is the most important commandment? What was his response? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And then he added, and the second is like unto it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And we might get the interpretation that, the most important commandment is to love God, and then below that is to love your neighbor. But in reality, the way it should have been understood, and it was understood, is that the two are equal. There is no priority difference.
That's how one is exhibited.
So that is, you asked about what sort of behavior allegiance should loyalty should lead to, and that is the behavior.
So, in United States history, one person would not be able to haze a black person where the other person culturally would be required to haze a black person.
And that would be the mark rather than be because they are marked. That the behavior difference would be the mark. Mm-hmm.
Even the 60s, you go south, you see the churches side by side, two doors.
What side by side?
The door for the blacks and the door for the whites, side by side.
And then they sit somewhere and still? No?
No, that was in the early 50s.
Oh.
Deep south.
Well, culturally, people kind of divide because they like different styles, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, and then some people may like to go to that church because they like that style that aren't normally of that culture. They might just like it.
That is a truth, but it's also an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
When it becomes an excuse, it's wrong. When it's truth, it's healthy.
when people are simply worshiping in a way that resonates with them and not expecting that it will, that there will be division, not expecting that you won't come
it's
here
in order
with
to
us.
Create division.
Yeah, not expecting that you're not going to come here with us because this is our thing and you're not going to join it.
One thing I read recently in a story, which I thought was intriguing, and it really made me think for a long time. Anyway, a young girl was born in, this is probably, you know, these all these stories are. Anyway, she was born into, this is back in England, right back when the earls or whatever who owned all the land, and then all their serfs or peasants, whatever, served the earls.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that was changing. And this one girl who was born into the aristocracy,
aristocracy,
said, which her parents totally rejected, that the poor people wanted
they wanted to know everything was okay by seeing the rich people spend lots of money.
Right.
Then they would know everything was okay.
So when my lord wears fancy clothes, that means that my community is healthy.
That was,
and the aristocrats believed that
that was their responsibility in life.
To,
and in
air
that way, were
that
they marked
feeling.
In one way or another? Were they marked as being selfish and self-reliant,
well,
rather than trusting God?
But the mother's response was, "No, so and so can sew this dress for you for a fraction of the cost, and because we have a responsibility to the populace to
use them
to you know, provide labor for them so that they can earn money for their income."
So we laugh at that, because how stupid it is for the aristocrats to think it's their responsibility in life to dress fancy in order that the populace can have confidence that their country or their whatever is good. But yet in our life, we do the same thing. We want to be in a bank that has all the fancy trimmings, because banks always try to exhibit those characteristics. Businesses try to exhibit those characteristics so that their constituents can look up to them. And then you take it back to kings. England loved their king and queen, and they wanted their king and queen to be an image of beauty, wealth, whatever, because the masses who loved their queen could not achieve to that level. And do we not do that, the same thing, to our government leaders? We want... So anyway, it really got me thinking, is to laugh at that girl and her situation. I think we're doing it in our own day and age in a different fashion.
But on the other hand, you don't want your president to get up maybe looking like Charlie, you know, and flaunting rags.
No, but this goes back to the Quakers not tilting their hat to the king. The king is our servant, not our lord. And that's what this is talking about. Are we going to be our neighbor's servant, or are we going to be our neighbor's lord? The mother that we started the discussion with understood to be the lord for your neighbor meant to be the servant.
And being the responsible person to the community.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing with these descriptions of the beasts is that the beasts, the dragon and the beasts, rely on force and manipulation to get what they want.
So it comes back to me as a form of government and as a form of thinking. And 666 is one number less than being right.
You say government, but government doesn't necessarily have to do that.
Do what?
Use force or manipulation.
No. No. Because the government reflects the individual.
Yeah. The instantiation of the abstract concept of government in this world, because it is run by and works for corrupt people. You know, every person is corrupted from the ideal, and so it reflects a corrupt nature.
And that's why we still have this problem on the earth. The universe saw God and how there's right government and wrong government on this earth. We haven't figured that out yet. So we're still on the sixes where God's on the sevens.
Well, continuing on this, 666. This verse is a typically cryptic apocalyptic riddle. There's an example of that in Matthew 24:15, if you're interested. Another example. 666 is a triangular number, but most ancient readers would not know that. It has often been thought a parody on the divine number 7. This is possible, but scholars more often turn to another explanation. Counting a name or word was an easy practice in Greek and Hebrew, which used letters as specific numbers. Later Jewish teachers often played with the numerical values of words. This form of calculation was known as gematria. Many ingenious proposals have been made for the meaning of 666. Irenaeus, a 2nd century Christian scholar, listed among the possibilities Latinos, meaning Rome as the final kingdom. But the most popular proposal among scholars today is Nero Caesar. Although his name comes out to 1005 in Greek, which would have been obvious because a familiar wordplay on that number of his name had circulated throughout the empire's graffiti, his name comes out to 666 if transliterated into Hebrew. If John intends an allusion to Nero here, either he expects his readers to know to switch to Hebrew letters, or he and they had already used 666 in this manner. That's one commentary. Now let's look at a different commentary. The second exhortation centers on the number of the beast. The challenge is for wisdom to calculate the number. John gives two clues. The first is that it is a human number rather than a divine one. It can be calculated by a person. The second is that the number is 666. Probably nothing in Revelation has spawned a wider array of interpretations than 666 as the mark of the beast. The reader must keep two points in mind, both of which are often lost on modern interpreters. First, in Revelation, the number is 666. In other words, it's written out that way, in words, not three sixes side by side. Second, as with everything else in the book, John expected his readers to make sense out of this number. But even keeping these two points in mind, it is not easy to grasp how John's readers would have understood the number. A common approach to calculating 666 is to use gematria, a practice attested in John's day for assigning a number to a name. A common scholarly interpretation of 666 is that it refers to Emperor Nero, but the fact that this suggestion requires that the Greek form Neron Caesar be transliterated into Hebrew with a defective spelling, along with the fact that John wrote in Greek to readers who probably could not read Hebrew in the first place, renders this interpretation doubtful. Given the symbolic use of numbers throughout the book, however, perhaps this one is intended symbolically as well. 7 is the number of completeness throughout Revelation. Perhaps 6 is intended to suggest incompleteness.
Oh, when I said one number short of being perfect.
Oh. But why 666?
Incomplete.
Yeah.
The Christian editor of Sibylline Oracles, Book 1, observed that the number of the name Jesus, or Jesus, is 888.
Oh, really?
Perhaps the idea is that 666 falls short of 888. So, as we can see, these two excerpts from commentaries, two different commentaries commenting on the 666, come to somewhat different conclusions, each coming to somewhat different conclusions. So I guess the point is, we don't know for sure exactly what John was intending with that use.
Well, where did 888 come from?
It's calculated out.
But in a perfect world, wouldn't Jesus be 777?
He's more than perfect.
Yeah, that's kind of 888.
It's not anywhere in the Bible, is it? Well, seven.
But we know it's one more than.
How many witnesses are there? Two or three?
Two.
Yeah. But it does make sense that six is short of perfect.
And more, eight is one more than perfect.
Yeah, to me that doesn't ring sensible. But who said that the Bible is nonsensical?
In other words, we don't know.
That's odd. With all of our archaeology and all of this, it just seems odd that you would lose something like that.
Well, you know what's odd to me is, why can't you turn the Bible upside down and read the real answer somewhere in the back? Why would they leave you with this, like, chance of making a mistake?
We all know that a steam engine is a railroad engine that runs on steam and heat. And basically they don't exist today. 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years from now, everybody should be able to find out from Wikipedia what a steam engine is. How could this information be lost? If it was widely known in Paul's day, why was it lost?
In other words, among people who read Revelation, why didn't they write it down and write down what they thought of it and keep it?
Well, the fact that it is a riddle means that writing it down may have been too dangerous.
Hmm. So what would be a current day example?
Because you couldn't name it on, hit the nail on the head, because your head might go rolling. Hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It was a commonly understood symbol for something.
Well, and that could weight it toward the first explanation with the Hebrew transliteration, because he could be using an obscure reference to Nero.
I could see where we would have, I don't know if this word would be slang, the only one that came to mind real quickly would be nigger. Nigger today, there's a lot of derogatory terms that were used 30 years ago that today are obsolete.
Well, honey, see, we're so out of it, you're still calling people black, and that's like calling them nigger now. So
it is.
So now, yeah. Oh yeah, we're so out of it, we don't even know what's politically correct.
I mean, African-American, I think, is the current politically correct.
Afro-American's gone.
It's African-American.
African-American. Yeah, I know. And Negro was preferred when we were little. But all those have gone away. And we're in
a new era. I could see a couple thousand years from now, those definitions and those nuances would be lost. Could be lost.
Especially if to explain them out loud, or to explain them in writing, would be politically dangerous.
Because not just your head, but many heads may roll. You know, he may have been not able to say it out loud.
We need to keep in mind that Revelation is a politically subversive piece of literature.
Uh-huh.
It is attacking the powerful of that time.
Uh-huh.
So it'd be like going to an anti-political rally.
And to call them by name would be dangerous, but to say his name is 666 and maybe quietly explain before or after or something like that, that, you know, if you do this, it could be mean.
So that's how the meaning got lost.
Maybe.
So in its day, it probably had. I liked your reference to modern graffiti. In its day, it was graffiti that everybody knew.
Well, the 1005 was graffiti.
Yeah, 1005 was graffiti for the
Nero.
For Nero in Greek.
But 666 could have been a similar
concept
that you don't put in. Yeah, that makes sense.
Did graffiti mean the same thing as it does today?
Well, it didn't have spray can back then.
Well, what was the emperor's graffiti? What does that mean?
I think empire's graffiti, throughout the empire's graffiti. I mean,
did graffiti mean something that people...
I think the commentary is using graffiti in the way that we understand it.
Oh, okay, got it.
The commentary would not use cryptic terminology.
They're trying to explain things, not trying to keep it unknown.
In other words, the emperor's graffiti is not like a picture that is promoted to mean the emperor. It's something that people are drawing to, something that the common people are using to mean the emperor.
The common people did not respect the emperor, would use it in a derogatory fashion.
Got it. I thought it meant like a symbol that had been promoted to symbolize.
Well, like if you were saying something to your friend that's putting himself up to be something he's not. What do you think you are? 1005? Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Where is that?
Another one would be...
Where's the graffiti?
Or writing on the walls down with 1005 or something.
Another one would be a good example would be if a Republican made a draw... Well, political cartoons. There you go. All political cartoons.
Yeah.
When they use
a symbol,
donkey or elephant in a derogatory fashion.
Or like, what was the one that had specific symbols for different people?
Well, at the Revolution, wasn't that very rife? Cartooning is not new.
So this is... So 666 might be sort of in use
Graffiti has, in its definition, has no connotation of respectable writing.
Yeah. Anyway.
Good point.
Anyway. All right. So where else are we going?
Except on the Big Dipper.
Big Dipper?
Out the road. That's respectable graffiti.
The
graduate.
All right.
But it is still technically not legal.
Oh, yeah, well.
Yeah, don't go there.
So.
If it was legal, then it wouldn't be any fun.
Yeah, it wouldn't be graffiti. All right. So, what might this all mean? Well, I put down three possible interpretations. One, interpretation A is historical, where the dragon represents Satan. The sea beast represents Rome, both pagan and religious. The Earth Beast represents the United States.
Amy, do you know what the Advent of Tradition is about? I thought maybe you didn't. The Advent have traditionally taught that the second beast is the United States.
And it comes up out of land instead of the ocean, which means it came out of something new.
Well, the sea represents something that is populated, according to this interpretation, and the land represents something that is unpopulated.
Right. So the United States came out of nothing. It came up as a very nice lamb, but then after a while
looking
it started
like a lamb,
speaking
like
a demon, and then it gave power to the first beast. So historically we say the United States is going to come up nice, as a Christian country, and then in time it's going to take over power and tell people that you have to worship the beast, which is Rome. And so the United States is going to enforce Roman Catholic...
And they say the number on the Pope's hat is 666. It's in Roman numerals, but...
It's not even there. Someone quotes Photoshop way back in the 1800s. A picture.
So, right, wrong, indifferent, if you look in Adventist history, you see that Adventist preaching is focused about the conflict between the United States and the Roman Catholic Church, joining hands with Protestantism and enforcing.
Well, that may be a possible application, and it certainly seemed possible when...
Kennedy, for instance.
Well, when the church first came about.
Yeah.
Or when the United States extended diplomatic contact with the Vatican.
And when Kennedy became president, because he was a Catholic, that would have been huge.
But each time those applications have failed to...
Pan out.
Yeah.
The United States did not actually say, okay, we're all going to be Catholics now.
But to go down that road, you have to assume that was the intent of somebody writing Revelation. Which I'm not sure that's the case.
Right.
So, Revelation was written by John, somebody.
Mm-hmm. For the seven churches in Asia Minor.
Correct. Uh-huh. And let's apply it to those churches first. And these secondary applications, or third or whatever, that may apply to John F. Kennedy being president. Nobody has given me, I guess I'm not there yet, that God has written down future in a book for me to see in the future.
To me, there may be future prediction in it, but that's not the primary purpose of it. There may be some there. But... Okay, anyway.
Any sort of predictive prophecy, its main intent is to confirm the trustworthiness of the source after the event.
Yeah.
It's not meant for us to use to try to make decisions that will benefit us.
For us to say, we know what's going to happen ahead of time.
I guess someday we're going to have to ask you to do Daniel. But to do Daniel, you're going to have to agree as to when it was written, and was it prophetic or was it history?
Yeah.
Go on. Okay. Anyway.
Second interpretation takes the position of a counterfeit Trinity, where the dragon represents again Satan, mm-hmm. counterfeit of God, the sea beast, a counterfeit of Jesus. And the earth beast, a counterfeit of the Holy Spirit. Now, there's some...
Well, then why would the earth beast be a lamb? Because the lamb symbolizes Jesus. Well, anyway. Okay.
Then there's some...
So where's the second one come from?
It's a common interpretation.
Uh-huh. About Nero?
No, in current day Protestantism, is my guess.
Yeah, the third interpretation is, for lack of a better term, it's kind of a counterfeit model of salvation. The dragon still represents Satan and represents a counterfeit of God. The sea beast continues to be a counterfeit of Jesus, but the earth beast represents counterfeit saints or counterfeit followers.
Isn't that one closer to what the Greeks would have read in Revelation?
Well, that's where we're going.
Oh, okay.
So how would John's readers in the seven churches have seen this passage? So the cult of emperor worship was very strong in this region. The first beast from the sea is seen as representing the imperial cult, the institution of the emperor. The second beast from the earth would be seen as representing all who promoted the imperial cult, such as the provincial council and the local imperial priesthood. In other words, the followers of the first beast and the dragon. The imperial temple in Ephesus served as a hub for the city and the region, and as a result it unified the citizens of that area. Non-participation was looked upon at minimum with deep suspicion. Potential economic and social fallout from non-participation, and there was enormous pressure to participate. Now we're going to look at a set of comparisons. The first one is between the dragon and God. Both are described as having a throne. The dragon gives throne and its authority to the first beast. God permits the lamb to take the scroll and shares the throne with the lamb. The dragon is worshipped along with the first beast. God is worshipped alongside the lamb. The dragon has a name. God has a name. These are, in parentheses, are all references back to Revelation. Second comparison is between the first beast from the sea and the lamb. The first beast has 10 horns and 7 heads. The lamb has 7 horns and 7 eyes. The first beast receives its throne and authority from the dragon. Lamb takes the scroll from the one seated upon the throne and shares the throne of God. The first beast has a mortal wound that was healed and lived. The lamb was slain but stood again. It died and lived. Men worship the dragon and the first beast. All of creation worships the one seated on the throne and the lamb. The first beast reigns for 42 months. The lamb reigns forever and ever. The first beast has authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. The lamb has ransomed people from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. The third comparison is between the second beast and the saints, or the two witnesses, or the servants of God, the seal, the woman, 44,000. The second beast, the duration of the reign of the first beast is 42 months, and so the activity of the second beast is the same. It's 42 months. The duration of the activity of the two witnesses is 1,260 days, or 42 months. The second beast does miracles. The two witnesses do miracles. The second beast makes fire come down from heaven. The two witnesses makes fire come out of their mouths. The second beast causes the image of the first beast to speak. The two witnesses speak or prophesy for God. The second beast causes those who refuse to worship the first beast to be slain. The two witnesses kill their foes. The second beast will later be called the false prophet in chapters 16 and 19. And the two witnesses are called prophets. So, making these comparisons then, it would appear that the dragon clearly represents a counterfeit of God. The beast from the sea, the first beast, is pretty clear that it's a counterfeit of Jesus. And this second beast from the earth, its comparisons with the description of the two witnesses then make it the best interpretation is probably that it is a counterfeit of the followers of Jesus, the saints. So you have the dragon, the first beast, as followers, God and the Lamb have their followers. And in both cases, the purpose of the saints or the purpose of the followers of the beast and the dragon is to witness and to testify on the behalf of their leaders. Additional comparisons. The dragon and the first beast seek worship. Only God and the Lamb are truly worthy of worship. The first beast portrays a death and resurrection. Only the Lamb has truly died and come back to life. So the first beast is, its resurrection is kind of a fake resurrection. It was asked of the beast, who is like the beast? Asked of the lamb, who is worthy? The beast cannot open the scroll or look into it. The lamb can take the scroll and open it. The reign of the first beast lasts a mere 42 months. It's limited, time limited. The reign of God and the lamb lasts forever. The second beast pretends to be associated with the lamb by having two horns like a lamb. But the lamb actually has seven horns. And the church is associated with the lamb through his death. Well, not through mere appearance, but through participation in what the lamb has gone through. The second beast can only mark his servants. God seals his servants on their foreheads.
There is a lamb.
A more permanent thing.
There is
mark.
A what?
Lamb.
There is a lamb with seven horns.
Oh, up here it says lamb, seven horns and seven eyes.
Yeah, in chapter 5, verse 6, the lamb is described as having seven horns and seven eyes.
Oh, okay.
So what can we say? Well, chapter 13 seems to describe a counterfeit of God, Jesus, and the church. And the dragon's primary weapon continues to be deception and accusation. People worship the counterfeit objects because they refuse to admit these are counterfeits. They know they're counterfeits, but they refuse to admit it because they have bought into the deception. And as a result, they willingly accept the mark. The dragon, through the first beast, utters blasphemies and shows a force of power. This show of power, is an attempt to discredit God, the Lamb, and the church, the genuine objects. It's an attempt by the dragon to show that he is in control, he has authority. But the truth is, the dragon is not in control, no matter how much power he may show. The dragon does succeed in deceiving people, but only those whose names are not written in the Book of Life. Both the first and second beasts are allowed, so in the divine passive, allowed their powers. And God is the one allowing, God is the one permitting the dragon to exercise his power. And what is described in chapter 13, it's a time of judgment against the sea and land when the message of the little scroll that we saw in chapter 10 is proclaimed. In that chapter, we saw that the angel is shown, angel holding the little scroll of judgment, is shown as standing on the sea and land. In other words, when it comes down to it, behind the scenes, the beasts, neither of the beasts are truly in control, even though they may portray that or want their followers to see that. So John's message to his fellow believers is that although visibly it would appear that powers against God are on the rise and even conquering his people, in the background God still retains the ultimate power and authority. Judgment may not be plainly visible, but nevertheless, it is being carried out. And God's people need not fear, but only patiently endure, because their names are in the Lamb's Book of Life, and they have been sealed. In other words, when it comes down to it, a person's ultimate destiny and relationship, saints have nothing to fear from what the world tries to throw at them. Because their names, their eternal security is safe with God. Now, again, it comes down to Revelation being less to do with trying to describe what's going to happen in the future and more as a message of reassurance from God to his church that even though things may appear bad right now, you're okay. Well, just trust me.
Don't make them worse than they are.